I'm Doug Wells.
Hi, I'm Roger Goldman. Welcome to Mountain Money.
And complained bitterly about the bite taken by the tax man in 1966, so too do many Americans resent the amounts paid to the IRS. Nonetheless, most of them pay the man.
But some do not. The IRS recently estimated that the tax gap, what they call the difference between the taxes owed to the government and the taxes paid, was about $600 billion in 2019 alone. Most of that unearned payment was not associated with wages, but with income that the IRS calls less visible sources of income, where compliance is estimated at less than 50%. The proposed American Family Plan includes a set of proposals designed to increase compliance, including some $80 billion in increased IRS resources, an expenditure that the IRS asserts would more than pay for itself. And of course, there are elements of the tax code that allow even high earners to legally avoid taxes. And this is a way that is sometimes hard to understand, much less justify.
So what are these less visible sources of income? And what kinds of schemes are used for tax avoidance? Has the IRS really been under-resourced in recent years? And if there are some new teeth added to IRS enforcement, who's likely to get bitten? We are lucky today to have experts who have seen the range of tax avoidance techniques from both the government and taxpayer side. Mark Matthews is the former chief of the IRS Criminal Division and Deputy IRS Commissioner for Services and Enforcement. Scott Michael has represented taxpayers since the early 1980s in criminal and civil tax enforcement actions, including everything from cases of unreported income to criminal tax shelter and conservation easement cases to cryptocurrency reporting failures. Both practice with a preeminent tax law firm of Kaplan and Drysdale. Good morning, gentlemen, and welcome to Mountain Money.
Morning, Roger.
Morning.
Thanks for joining us. Okay, let's start with, you know, a fundamental premise. To what extent does the tax system, in fact, rely on voluntary compliance?
This is Mark. I'll start off on that first one. It's huge. It's not called a voluntary compliance system for no reason. It really, that is the backbone of it. And the vast majority of people get something like a W-2 or a 1099 if you're in a partnership and a K-1. And all of that gets reported up to the IRS. So whether or not they were inclined to cheat or minimize sort of doesn't matter because they realize the IRS has it. So they know that number is going to be matched by the IRS computers. And so those, by and large, get accurately reported. The problem in the system is where there's no such third party reporting. So you can think about a Schedule C taxpayer, somebody with a small business. The vast majority of their income doesn't get reported. LLC, there's no third-party reporting there. Cash businesses have traditionally been a huge problem here. And you've heard about things like the second set of books or just the cash in the envelope. There's huge potential for abuse there. International activity. The IRS has been on a massive campaign for about 10 years, shutting down foreign accounts and foreign trusts. So when you think about that tax gap that you mentioned at the beginning of the program, the W-2 crowd, which is probably most of your listeners, they are 98% compliant. They are almost none of that problem, of the tax gap. It's primarily the small business taxpayers that Schedule C, the cash and the like. And there's some studies inside the IRS of the tax gap which would say those folks are reporting maybe barely over 50% of their income. So that, as you can see, is a huge tax advantage to them and a tax problem for the government.
So those are some sources of this less transparent income. Outside of that, though, let's talk about some tax avoidance strategies that you've seen, some of the creative ways that people get out of paying taxes, whether legally or subject to interpretation, should we say.
Sure. This is Scott. Let me the tax schemes can range from, you know, very simple, the sort of things that Mark was alluding to, people skimming cash out of a business, or paying personal expenses out of their company and deducting them as business costs, or off-book payrolls, or engaging, for example, in, you know, employment tax evasion, where you have a business that's struggling and unable to pay its employees' taxes, and so they just don't withhold the taxes. Those are fairly simple, fairly common schemes. But then you can also have very sophisticated schemes. Back in the early 2000s, the government engaged in a massive enforcement effort against large accounting and law firms that were marketing these magical tax shelter schemes for dot-com millionaires who had liquidated their stock positions and made enormous capital gains. And these professionals put together these programs where if you signed a stack of papers, created seven partnerships, borrowed money from a bank and paid it back in 30 days, and waved your arms, you could get rid of your capital gains tax liability. The government went after those with a vengeance, both criminally and civilly. One of the schemes you see now are what are called syndicated conservation easements, where promoters purchase large parcels of real estate and then divvy up those units to allow people to donate conservation easements and take large deductions for the value of that easement. You also see a lot of activity in the foreign account and foreign trust arena still, where people are using structures located overseas to hide income, for example, that they earn overseas in these sophisticated structures. So they can range from the simple to the complex.
So how does the last one you referenced, Scott, the foreign hiding of assets, foreign, how does that work? How would someone try to pull that off to show income in a foreign jurisdiction and not report it?
Well, it's getting increasingly difficult. The standard template was to go to Switzerland, open a bank account in the name of a Liechtenstein Foundation or a Panama company, or sometimes a structure would have both, and then direct income into that structure, either sort of directly from the U.S. by having people, pay your foreign consulting company rather than you and having the transfers made into your foreign structure, or people who, had income earned overseas that they were able to direct into the structure. Roger, I know you're a film buff. One of the situations we saw was a very famous Hollywood persona who created a foreign structure and had all of the foreign distribution profits and payments go into this. Now, this is getting harder because Congress passed a law about 10 years ago promoting and expanding international information exchange, and so foreign banks and foreign governments are now supposed to be reporting this more, but there are still ways that we see taxpayers avoid this, and the IRS has taken a long time to ramp up and its enforcement of and its ability to use this information.
Yeah, and I know you've referenced the agreements that the U.S. government has with some of these foreign entities. So the ability to hide assets overseas has obviously gotten much more difficult, as it should be. And I have heard of a move where some people are actually renouncing their U.S. citizenship to avoid taxes. Talk to us about how people do that and where do they go?
It's Mark, I'll take a little bit of that. When the whole offshore Swiss thing really took off, we used to joke around the office we were going to need to put in a turnstile for our expatriation business. I mean, that's an exaggeration, but there were a lot of U.S. citizens who got interested in leaving, particularly U.S. citizens who already lived abroad, and there are about 7 million of them who live abroad. And so between... And by the way, most of them were paying taxes in other countries and the like, so they didn't consider themselves these big tax criminals. In fact, some had been born in the United States and left, their mother stayed to deliver them, and then they left, and not even in Brazil for 50 years, and suddenly realize, I'm a U.S. citizen. I owe all these back taxes. So there was a lot of frustration, and this process to expatriate is not that complex. You should seek a professional of some sort to do that. But basically, as long as you can, for most people, let's put it this way, there's some complex, and if you're extremely wealthy, you really want to be careful. But for most people, as long as you file 5 years, or can say you filed 5 years of tax returns, you just walk into the embassy, you get an appointment, you answer a few questions, and then ultimately you file a final tax return the next year to cover that partial year, and you're no longer a U.S. citizen. People are going everywhere. Every tax haven anywhere in Europe, there are some favorites for like the St. Kitts, the Maltas of the world, which really welcome people and have low residency requirements. Scott, any other things in terms of expatriation?
Yeah, the one thing to note, I mean, Mark alludes to this, and he's right, that if you're wealthy, this is a very different process, because wealthy people do have to pay what's called an exit tax. But there are ways that we have seen people plan around that in order to really minimize their liability. I think that there have been a few thousand people expatriating every year since the IRS ramped up this foreign enforcement activity in 2009, 2010, and I think that's going to continue.
Let's talk a little bit about...
Sort of Mark again.
Go ahead, Mark. Go ahead, Mark.
No, you say one of the horrible things as a U.S. citizen, you tell some parents abroad, you're talking to them about this whole process, and then you tell them at some point, have you thought about the fact that your children might be U.S. citizens? And it's like you just said they might have cancer. I mean, there's this like, oh, my God, say it isn't so. Can you help us cure this? So it's in my lifetime, it's been an odd point where a U.S. citizen was a badge of honor to something that let's get rid of this as fast as we can.
We've talked a bit this morning so far about tax avoidance schemes and what I would call the offense. Let's talk a little bit about the defense. Tell us a little bit about the enforcement and compliance functions within the government to track tax compliance. Has it changed much over the last 20 years, and how does it work?
Yeah, first of all, just on the tracking point, you mentioned the tax gap again. About every 6 to 8 years, the IRS does the tax gap study where they pick a few thousand taxpayers and intensively audit them. One congressman called it an autopsy without the benefit of death. They've made it a little bit less painful over the years. They sort of statistically spread it out, if you will, and then they extrapolate from all that, and that's where you get your tax gap study. So that's how it's tracked. It does change. 25 years ago, 30 years ago when I started in this business, for instance, trusts were seen as some of the most compliant tax devices in the world, extremely low audit rates because there was just no there. Now trusts are some of the most audited, especially foreign trusts, because some of the things that Scott was talking about. So now it's cryptocurrency. Right? Not even on anybody's radar a long time ago, but suddenly cryptocurrency seems to be, from the IRS's perspective, one of the greatest threats, potentially, not only the U.S., but global tax evasion. So it does, the problems morph over time.
Let me just add that to your point about how it's changed over the last 20 years. I mean, as everybody remembers, there was a political scandal, 10-ish years ago, where the IRS was thought to be targeting conservative groups. And this has resulted in a massive decline in IRS funding. At the outset of the show, you were talking about the Biden plan. I mean, that's what the Biden plan is really trying to do is reverse this significant decline in IRS funding. They've lost a lot of people. They're working off of antiquated, IT. I think they're still using computers that Mortimer Kaplan, who founded our law firm, put in place in West Virginia in 1962. So, with old-fashioned tape drives. So that's the point of this approach here, to try to get them more funding so they can ramp up and be more, you talk about defense, be more competitive with the very wealthy who are able to skirt the tax rules and with big companies who are able to plan around it.
And we all know that lobbying has, unfortunately, an inordinate effect on our politics. Are there lobbying organizations that are fighting hard against this? It seems like the more you fight against it, the more you might be a target for an audit.
It's Mark again. They don't. The IRS is pretty careful not to sort of target people based on legitimate political activity. Talk about trouble. That'd be a headline out there. I would hazard a guess that the tax code may be the most heavy lobby target in the entire United States government. Maybe defense spending, I don't know. I'm not an expert in lobbying, but there is a huge, huge industry around that. And every time a tax bill starts to go through, it's a feeding frenzy to go after that. And lobbyists and taxpayers are not dumb. The people who are the best at exploiting the current loopholes in the system either legally or those whose business setup is set up to allow them even illegally to do it, those people tend to resist IRS enforcement in these devices. Now, you know, nobody loves the IRS. As a former IRS guy, I can say this confidently. Nobody loves the IRS. We could talk later about jury trials. That's an interesting thing when you're trying to get a jury to pull the trigger in an IRS case. But the irony is the vast majority of Americans actually have a financial interest in a modestly, at least reasonably robust enforcement regime, because they're unlikely to be audited, less likely to be audited. They're likely to satisfy it more quickly. And their taxes over time would actually come down if some of the most wealthy were paying their share as directed by Congress. They would actually pay less over time. So the politics of the tax code is always frustrating.
Just can you help our listeners understand a little bit about how enforcement breaks down between the IRS, criminal justice, and civil justice?
Sure. What most people think of is they know things like audits, criminal investigations, collection activity, that kind of thing. Scott mentioned the FECA program. So there's a lot of routine, just tracking, auditing stuff. Just to mention it, the IRS does an enormous amount of educational activities. They put, you know, they got publications, regulations, their websites, phone assistants, when you can ever get them on the phone, right? And that's a huge issue. Now, how do people who want to do the right thing, when they can't even get on the phone, what do? Now, those activities are directed to people who are at least trying to do the right thing, right? Most of that doesn't speak to the people who are trying not to do the right thing. So that's sort of the IRS end of it. And the IRS then works, and the most typical model sort of finds a case, sees what they call badges of fraud. So it started off as an audit, but now the auditor's saying, wait a second, this doesn't match. That cash over here, this, I'm seeing these wire transfers there. Then it might move to the criminal side of the IRS, the folks who used to work for me, the special agents, those are the guns and badges types. And or then or fairly soon thereafter, they call the Department of Justice when they want sort of the grand jury tools, right? Now we're talking about no more white glove treatment, no more polite summonses and exchanges. Now we're talking about things like grand juries, search warrants, undercover programs, a much more robust program there. They do things like the IRS relies on the whistleblower program increasingly. That's something that a few of the senators really promote, and a whistleblower can get as much as a third of the recovery of what the IRS gets. And the most famous is a guy named Brad Birkenfeld, who started the whole snowball blowing with the Swiss banks. He got $104 million check from the Internal Revenue Service because he was the guy who came in and dined out this thing and got that going. He also did 3 years in prison because he was a bad guy. But at $104 million a year, it wasn't the worst payoff, I guess, personally for him. Scott, you got...
Yeah, you know, the IRS relies a lot on deterrence, hoping that people will be motivated to be in compliance. I mean, they only bring about 1,000 criminal cases a year nationwide, for example. And if you think about the fact that we're a country of over 300 million people, that's a small number. So they look at it, they look for cases where they can get some headlines and send some messages. I have said to clients that, you know, you can think the audit rate is very low and that your chances of getting caught are quite small, but, you know, the IRS is sort of like the eye of Sauron or a giant searchlight. It's just kind of going round and round, and it may not land on you, and the odds are that it won't, but if it does, you're in real trouble, and that's the risk calculus that IRS enforcement tries to leverage.
Well, let's do the IRS a public service here. What happens to the average person? You know, let's say the restaurateur that is only reporting half of their income, the two sets of books. Unfortunately, the dice land the wrong way, and they're the subject of an audit, and they get caught. What happens to people like that?
Well, first of all, there is the chance, even before they get caught, that for people in that situation who, you know, for whatever reason, wake up one morning and decide, you know, I really should fix this, The IRS does welcome voluntary disclosures. It would if that restaurateur were to walk into Mark's or my office without an IRS audit hanging over their head, you know, we would probably advise them that they should consider filing amended returns and doing the best they can to pay their tax. Even if they can't afford to pay everything, they would likely avoid criminal prosecution if they came forward and fixed it. Now, once the audit begins, what happens to that restaurateur is going to depend in part on how easy it would be for the IRS to prove fraud. Tax fraud in the criminal context is what they call a specific intent crime. So the IRS and the Department of Justice would have to prove that that restaurateur knew what she was doing, knew that she was crossing a line, knew that she was violating a law. That's a very heavy burden of proof to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So if somebody's been aggressive and playing around, you know, it's sort of more likely that they would be treated in a civil context. They would owe tax, they would owe interest, they could owe penalties. If there are significant badges of fraud, if they have really been hiding money, if they've been making false entries on their books, if they've been enlisting other parties to help them cheat, then it's more likely the case would get flipped for potential criminal investigation.
I have many more questions for Scott Michael and Mark Matthews, but unfortunately we are out of time. Gentlemen, thanks for spending time with us. If they pass the bill, we may ask you to come back and explain to us what it means. Thanks for listening. If you enjoy the show, make sure you leave a review no matter how you listen. And we'd appreciate it if you clicked 5 stars.